I'm Dorothy Bors, and I do teach here. I'm an aquatic ecologist. But one of the reasons I'm interested in this subject is because in 2011, I was the lead author on a paper that was published by the National Association of Evangelicals called Loving the Least of These, Addressing a Changing Environment. The goal of that was to put a human face on climate change and to make a connection in the minds of Christians between poverty and the effects of climate change, because climate change, like most environmental degradation, harms the poorest people the most. So that's going to be where we're coming from. So I'm going to follow something similar to this. We'll talk about different timelines of Massachusetts, and we're going to focus on what happened in Massachusetts politically, and as the population changed, as Europeans settled it, what happened as the American environmentalist movement came in, and what the environmental justice movement is, and then we'll talk about climate change awareness and concern, and how is that climate overlap a place for multiple restoration. So to do so, we have to imagine ourselves in 1600. Oh my goodness, that file is not found. What will we do? Oh, you know what? A Wayback Machine. Travel with me in a Wayback Machine to no, this is not 1600. We're in 12,000 years ago, and we look around. Help! We get back in our Wayback Machine. 1600, we escaped the Pleistocene, when right where we are standing, there was a mile of ice above us. And because of that, the ocean waters were so low that the continental shelf that's now under the ocean was all land. And the islands off of the coast of Massachusetts were not islands, they were hills. In 1600, however, it looked a lot more like this, and in fact, Native American tribes lived in this area of Massachusetts and in New England generally. The tribes were in a group called the Algonquin Language Group, and so sometimes you will hear them called the Algonquins, but they actually had separate tribal names. The one that's where we are right now was called the Wampanoag. And that was actually a set of about 60 sub-tribes. At one point in history, there were about 12,000 Wampanoags in Massachusetts and Rhode Island. But at the time of European settlement, there were about 6,600, and about 3,000 of them lived on Martha's Vineyard, and they lived on the islands and then up around the Massachusetts Bay. Wampanoags did some moving. They went from coastal zones where they had agriculture, and they planted what were called the Three Sisters, squash and beans and maize. And then they survived on hunting, berry gathering, and fishing. If we were to look at trees, they might have looked something like this. There were forests dominated by very large trees and relatively little understory. Now, we are going to speed through time and watch just what happened to forests in New England. So we're going to leap ahead. We'll watch this. It's about 2 minutes or something, and that will save me from having to say it all. It's here. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sorry, guys. I can't even see the X in my reading glasses. Next one, go. Get me out of here. This is not my computer. Although, to be honest, I'm not very good at this even when it is my computer. Okay. How did we end up back there? You can see us running through time again. Okay. So we just saw a series of dioramas made by Harvard Forest, which is an experimental forest owned by Harvard in the middle of Massachusetts. And they showed a series of what forests look like. One of the reasons that the forests looked the way they did in 1600 was because the Wampanoag managed the forest with fire. The dominance of oaks, hickories, and chestnuts was not an accident. Those big nut-bearing trees have thick, hard bark that is fire-resistant. And the Native Americans would spread fire, and that would cut down on the undergrowth, which made hunting with a bow and arrow possible, because you had to be able to see a shot and you had to be able to walk without making noise. And likewise, it encouraged the growth of high bush blueberry and huckleberry. And along the coast, it opened up a swath of grasslands that were several miles wide. Now, next we'll talk about what happened with the Wampanoag and a little bit about the mixed blessing of having anybody come here. So, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, when it was formed, and I'll give you some information about that in a minute, had a seal, and it shows their depiction of a Native American, and out of his mouth it says, "Come over and help us." So when the pilgrims came to this area in America, their thinking was that they would be a benefit to the Native Americans here, both culturally because of civilization, and because they were bringing the gospel. If you were just to look at the number of Wampanoag in periods of time, you might doubt that they were beneficial. For example, in 1610, there were about 6,600, and in 1620, that dropped because of an epidemic. There had been an epidemic immediately before that because there were just a few people that came over with what they call virgin diseases, meaning the population was not used to that. Smallpox was one and leptospirosis was another. And then, as we'll see later, in the three quarters of the way through the 1600s, there was a big war. That King Philip's War, King Philip refers to actually a leader of the Wampanoags who had another name to his people, but people called him King Philip. And that war was so devastating that many of the towns were razed to the ground and most of the Indians were killed. And then if we leap forward today, are there Wampanoags in Massachusetts? Absolutely. There's two tribes, and they are represented and federally recognized. But let me just go back. Okay, no. I'm looking for a link. Yes. Now, I spent an inordinate amount of time making a timeline of Massachusetts. And then I realized I didn't want to print it for you. And it was like, it would have been 50 slides. I'm not kidding. So I posted it here on the wonderofeverydaynature.com. If you want to follow a timeline of cool stuff happening in Massachusetts that I will refer to, feel free to go to that. It should be under timeline, but I'm not going to click out to it myself because I want to move along. Okay, so we talked about the Wampanoags. And this just summarizes. In the 1600s, they were decimated by illness and war, but they got the first time their language was ever written by, and it was when the Bible was written in their language. And then they proceeded to write all sorts of other things in their own language. And that was the first development of writing for that group. We will later see the French and Indian Wars, in which the French collaborated with certain groups of Indians, and the English and Dutch collaborated with other groups of Indians, and great wars were fought, and not all in Massachusetts, but so many people from Massachusetts died that they're well worth knowing. But by the mid-1800s, the Wampanoag language was lost. By 1974, Massachusetts made an Indian Affairs Commission, so it's hundreds of years into this. And in 1993, there was an effort to revive the language. And the Wampanoag have about 3,000 in two tribes here at the most recent census, but there's about 37,000 Native Americans in Massachusetts. Now, why would I say all that? Because we've already seen a really mixed effect of people coming from Europe. And we will also see that on the land. As you saw with the forest little clip, the biggest outcome of European settlement was rapid and thorough deforestation. This is in the 1980, and it is in Petersham, Massachusetts, and you can see that it's mostly open fields. We'll return to that picture in a minute. So you think, did people know? Did they know that something was going awry, that erosion was happening? Well, actually, in 1864, this George Perkins Marsh wrote a book called Man and Nature, or Physical Geography as Modified by Human Action, in which he argued that deforestation could lead to desertification. He's sometimes considered America's first environmentalist, and of course, nobody paid any attention to him at all. But we're going to leap right ahead in this picture so that you know the end of the story, at least on forests. This is today in Petersham. And the regrowth of forests has been one of the dominant stories of the 1900s and the 2000s in Massachusetts. But because of fire suppression, and because it takes a long time to grow a big tree, these forests are nothing like what they were a few hundred years ago. Okay, so that's forests. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about fishing, because this region was dominated by fishing. In fact, in the 1500s, European sailing vessels were coming over and fishing. And what were they fishing? Cod. And why were they fishing cod? Because cod was very easy to catch, and it could be salted and dried because it doesn't have a lot of fat. So because it could be salted and dried, it was then the food everybody used on sailing ships and many other places as well. But because it could be stored so well, cod was a huge commodity. In fact, in the 1500s, there was a fight between the English fleet and the Spanish and Portuguese fleet, in which the English killed a lot of people, gutted a lot of boats, and got the use of what is considered one of the biggest fisheries and most productive in the whole world, the Grand Banks. Now, we are off of George's Bank. If you went out on the boat on Monday, we didn't go as far as that, but but George's Bank is off of the coast of Massachusetts, and the Grand Banks is off the coast of Newfoundland. Now, what happened? What happened is, unfortunately, a sad tale. I'll only give the summary of. These two maps show the concentration of fish biomass. The redder, the more biomass. The lighter color, the over here, the less biomass. So this was Atlantic cod catches and estimated abundances in 1850. And this is Atlantic cod estimated biomass from abundances in 2005. What I'm hoping you can see is that the quick version of fisheries is we fished them out. In fact, it's even worse than that. We had people coming from other countries on big vessels. We had people that developed sonar and refrigeration so you didn't have to come back into shore. We switched from certain kinds of fishing to bottom trawlers that were very destructive. And then when it looked like the fish were declining, a lot more people started fishing. Right now, we don't have a fishery for cod in either George's Bank or the Grand Banks. But by 1934, people were saying we might be fishing too much. This was in a report on fisheries. So what do we see? 1934, we wondered if there was a problem, but the Grand Banks did not get solved, and in 1993, that whole fishery was closed, and 35,000 Newfoundlanders lost their jobs abruptly. Gone was 400 towns' way of life. And did we learn anything in Massachusetts? In 2013, we had to close the cod fishery in George's Bank because apparently not. Okay, so one other word I want to make about is grasslands. And grasslands were very dominant along the coast. And they are the place where certain types of wildlife live, especially grassland birds. This is an arc projecting the number of grassland birds over time. They were the highest in 1850. So that's not intuitive, but it might be if you thought, oh look, they had all these farms, they're beginning to abandon them, and they're growing up into grasslands. There's a lot more there. But you can see that they're coming down. In fact, grassland bird species in many areas, but especially in New England, are in tremendous decline. Okay, so I just talked rapidly about Massachusetts, but I want Massachusetts in your mind to represent the world, because we would have seen the same things around the world in different ways. But let's look at what happened to our understanding. So way back before 1900, but well after the 1600s, we started forming societies. The Wildlife Conservation Society started in 1885. The National Geographic Society, which is listed as one of the more important environmental groups because of the amount it does now to inform readers about environmental degradation, was that. And I am not going to read through them all, but you can see we're coming in to, we're building. And I'm going to see if you can see a trend here. The largest environmental group in the world is the World Wildlife Fund from 1961. Of course, that's worldwide and not just here. And then you can see some of the others that are coming up. And as you come down, you see sort of a shift to a more holistic view. But what is true of these groups is that they tend to be dominated by whites, and they reflect the values of wealthy people, in particular, land protection separate from people, and protection of species, especially species people like. So there's a lot of birders. Birds are high priority. There's a lot of hunters, ducks unlimited. There's a lot of fishers, trout unlimited. People have their niche, and that's what they funded. So now there's a little bit more about ecosystems, a little bit more about people, but today, still, minorities are underrepresented on boards, staff, and volunteers of these mainstream environmental groups. In one study in 2014, they list that all many, many facts about this. But one of the things that has happened is, as they've tried to diversify from being largely white and male, they've solved the male-female ratio more than they have solved the majority-minority racial issue. In other surveys, minorities are less likely to hike, camp, do nature photography, or use national parks. But not everybody interprets that the same way. A survey of National Park Service employees showed that they believe minorities do not use national parks as often because they're not interested. But minorities who were surveyed report that there are barriers to their use, fear of their treatment in the outdoors, cost or travel or others. Likewise, when the survey of who works for environmental groups was done, it showed that environmental groups want diversity, and they believe that the lack of diversity is due to a lack of interest and qualified minority applicants. But in fact, that's not the case. Surveys show there is an interest and there's plenty of experience, but there's no pipeline because most jobs are gotten through word of mouth. And recruitment is not done in areas that are historically have more minorities. So what that has set us up for is a disjunct between the minority experience in America and people talking about the environment. Welcome to climate change, a huge global problem that is affecting cities as well as the countryside. This is a quote from a woman at the NAACP. In the past, and to some extent still now, when people think of environmentalism, they often think of saving the whales or hugging trees. When folks think about climate change, what comes to mind are melting ice caps and suffering polar bears. But in that same quote on the NAACP website, the woman goes on to say that, in fact, minority communities are badly hurt by climate change. Now I'm going to give a very brief conversation about environmental justice, a parallel but slightly later track. This is a picture of Warren County, North Carolina in 1982, when I was graduating from high school. Does anybody remember this? Do you remember? People protested for weeks. They laid down in front of trucks. They marched. It was not racially divided. In fact, whites and minorities marched together because this was the poorest county in North Carolina, and the government was gonna dump a lot of PCBs in a dump there. And they said, "Don't dump on us." And then, some years later, in 1991, the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit of 300 people developed a document called Environmental Justice Videos. I think we're going to have to skip the video here, but there is a little link there. So just in case you don't think there's an injustice based on race and class in environmental outcomes, that POC just means persons of color are, and we won't spend time on citing all of these, but they're more likely to live near a Superfund site, near a coal plant, have elevated lead in their blood, have asthma, be exposed to chlorine, be exposed to particulates, or lack healthy foods. Now, what happens with climate change? Likewise, people of color spend higher percent of income on heating and cooling than whites. They're more likely to depend on natural income if they live in places where they have to harvest something. They're more likely to have food insecurity and, in some studies, to die in heat waves, especially in urban environments, to lose land in floods, as we saw in several of the hurricanes that hit the Gulf, to lack insurance or to be unable to pay for climate adaptations. In Massachusetts, one of the critical concerns is about sea level rise. And this is projected and current sea level rise in a station in Boston Harbor. This is a picture of what will be flooded in Boston if the minimum happens and if the worst happens. And what you should see is that a lot of important things in Boston need some plan. So here's where the overlap comes. Here are very sincere people over here trying to protect the environment. And here's a group of people fighting for the environment where they live. Usually they're small groups fighting about something right there. Pollution or access to something. So I'm going to say that when we do things to solve climate change, they shouldn't be done if they don't have a lens of equity, inclusion, and justice. That is, it's not a good action if it doesn't include everybody. So this is Mariama White Hammond. I met her at a meeting about climate change. She's the ecological justice minister at Bethel American Methodist Episcopal Church. And she said, if we're going to remake society, we can't remake it without addressing equity. So with that idea that this is actually a juncture that gives us the possibility of solving multiple problems at one time, but it also offers us the moral imperative that we do so. I'm gonna leave you on that thought. Okay. Now, I ran a little over because of the